Denisov was bandaged up again and put to bed. Next day he woke calm and cheerful. But at noon the adjutant of the regiment came into Rostov and Denisov's dugout with a grave and serious face and regretfully showed them a paper addressed to Major Denisov from the regimental commander, in which inquiries were made about yesterday's occurrence. The adjutant told them that the affair was likely to take a very bad turn, that a court-martial had been appointed, and that in view of the severity with which marauding and insubordination were now regarded, degradation to the ranks would be the best that could be hoped for. The case, as represented by the offended parties, was that after seizing the transports, Major Denisov, being drunk, went to the chief quartermaster and without any provocation called him a thief, threatened to strike him, and on being led out had rushed into the office and given two officials a thrashing and dislocated the arm of one of them. In answer to Rostov's renewed questions, Denisov said, laughing, that he thought he remembered that some other fellow had got mixed up in it, but that it was all nonsense and rubbish, and he did not in the least fear any kind of trial, and that if those scoundrels dared attack him, he would give them an answer that they would not easily forget. Denisov spoke contemptuously of the whole matter, but Rostov knew him too well not to detect that, while hiding it from others, at heart he feared a court-martial and was worried over the affair, which was evidently taking a bad turn. Every day letters of inquiry and notices from the court arrived, and on the 1st of May Denisov was ordered to hand the squadron over to the next in seniority and appear before the staff of his division to explain his violence at the commissariat office. On the previous day, Platov reconnoitred with two Cossack regiments and two squadrons of hussars. Denisov, as was his wont, rode out in front of the outposts, parading his courage. A bullet fired by a French sharpshooter hit him in the fleshy part of his leg. Perhaps at another time Denisov would not have left the regiment for so slight a wound, but now he took advantage of it to excuse himself from appearing at the staff, and went into hospital. Chapter 17. Nikolai visits Denisov in hospital. In June the Battle of Friedland was fought, in which the Pavlograds did not take part, and after that an armistice was proclaimed. Rostov, who felt his friend's absence very much, having no news of him since he left and feeling very anxious about his wound and the progress of his affairs, took advantage of the armistice to get leave to visit Denisov in hospital. The hospital was in a small Prussian town that had been twice devastated by Russian and French troops. Because it was summer, when it is so beautiful out in the fields, the little town presented a particularly dismal appearance, with its broken roofs and fences, its foul streets, tattered inhabitants, and the sick and drunken soldiers wandering about. The hospital was in a brick building with some of the window frames and panes broken, and a courtyard surrounded by the remains of a wooden fence that had been pulled to pieces. Several bandaged soldiers with pale, swollen faces were sitting or walking about in the sunshine in the yard. Directly Rostov entered the door, he was enveloped by a smell of putrefaction and hospital air. On the stairs he met a Russian army doctor smoking a cigar. The doctor was followed by a Russian assistant. "I can't tear myself to pieces," the doctor was saying. "Come to Makar Alexeyevich in the evening. I shall be there." The assistant asked some further questions. "Oh, do the best you can. Isn't it all the same?" The doctor noticed Rostov coming upstairs. "What do you want, sir?" said the doctor. "What do you want? The bullets having spared you, do you want to try typhus? This is a pest house, sir."
"How so?" asked Rostov.
"Typhus, sir, it's death to go in. Only we two, Makeyev and I," he pointed to the assistant, "keep on here. Some five of us doctors have died in this place. When a new one comes, he's done for in a week," said the doctor with evident satisfaction. "Prussian doctors have been invited here, but our allies don't like it at all."
Rostov explained that he wanted to see Major Denisov of the Hussars, who was wounded.
"I don't know, I can't tell you, sir. Only think, I'm alone in charge of three hospitals with more than 400 patients. It's well that the charitable Prussian ladies send us 2 pounds of coffee and some lint each month, or we should be lost," he laughed. 400, sir!
and they're always sending me fresh ones. There are 400, eh? He asked, turning to his assistant. The assistant looked fagged out. He was evidently vexed and impatient for the talkative doctor to go. Major Denisov, Rostov said again. He was wounded at Molitin. Dead, I fancy, eh, Makeyev? Queried the doctor, in a tone of indifference. The assistant, however, did not confirm the doctor's words. Is he tall and with reddish hair? Asked the doctor. Rostov described Denisov's appearance. There was one like that, said the doctor, as if pleased. That one is dead, I fancy. However, I'll look up our list. We had a list. Have you got it, Makeyev?
Makar Alexeyevich has the list, answered the assistant. But if you'll step into the officer's wards, you'll see for yourself, he added, turning to Rostov.
Ah, you'd better not go, sir, said the doctor, or you may have to stay here yourself.
But Rostov bowed himself away from the doctor and asked the assistant to show him the way.
Only don't blame me,
the doctor shouted up after him. Rostov and the assistant went into the dark corridor. The smell was so strong there that Rostov held his nose and had to pause and collect his strength before he could go on. A door opened to the right, and an emaciated, sallow man on crutches, barefoot and in underclothing, limped out, and leaning against the doorpost, looked with glittering, envious eyes at those who were passing. Glancing in at the door, Rostov saw that the sick and wounded were lying on the floor on straw and overcoats.
May I go in and look?
What is there to see?
Said the assistant. But just because the assistant evidently did not want him to go in, Rostov entered the soldier's ward. The foul air to which he had already begun to get used in the corridor was still stronger here. It was a little different, more pungent, and one felt that this was where it originated. In the long room, brightly lit up by the sun through the large windows, the sick and wounded lay in two rows with their heads to the walls and leaving a passage in the middle. Most of them were unconscious and paid no attention to the newcomers. Those who were conscious raised themselves or lifted their thin yellow faces and all looked intently at Rostov with the same expression of hope, of relief, reproach, and envy of another's health. Rostov went to the middle of the room and, looking through the open doors into the two adjoining rooms, saw the same thing there. He stood still, looking silently around. He had not at all expected such a sight. Just before him, almost across the middle of the passage on the bare floor, lay a sick man, probably a Cossack, to judge by the cut of his hair. The man lay on his back, his huge arms and legs outstretched. His face was purple, his eyes were rolled back so that only the whites were seen, and on his bare legs and arms, which were still red, the veins stood out like cords. He was knocking the back of his head against the floor, hoarsely uttering some word which he kept repeating. Rostov listened and made out the word. It was drink, drink, a drink. Rostov glanced around, looking for someone who would put this man back in his place and bring him water.
Who looks after the sick here? He asked the assistant.
Just then, a commissariat soldier, a hospital orderly, came in from the next room, marching stiffly, and drew up in front of Rostov.
Good day, Your Honour,
he shouted, rolling his eyes at Rostov, and evidently mistaking him for one of the hospital authorities.
Get into his place and give him some water, said Rostov, pointing to the Cossack.
Yes, Your Honour,
the soldier replied complacently, and rolling his eyes more than ever, he drew himself up still straighter, but did not move.
No, it's impossible to do anything here, thought Rostov, lowering his eyes, and he was going out, but became aware of an intense look fixed on him on his right, and he turned. Close to the corner, on an overcoat, sat an old, unshaven, grey-bearded soldier, as thin as a skeleton, with a stern, sallow face and eyes intently fixed on Rostov. The man's neighbour on one side whispered something to him, pointing at Rostov, who noticed that the old man wanted to speak to him. He drew nearer and saw that the old man had only one leg bent under him. The other had been amputated above the knee. His neighbour on the other side, who lay motionless some distance from him with his head thrown back, was a young soldier with a snubbed nose. His pale, waxen face was still freckled, and his eyes were rolled back. Rostov looked at the young soldier,
and a cold chill ran down his back.
"Why, this one seems—"
he began, turning to the assistant.
"And how we've been begging, Your Honour," said the old soldier, his jaw quivering. "He's been dead since morning. After all, we're men, not dogs."
"I'll send someone at once. He shall be taken away, at once," said the assistant hurriedly. "Let us go, Your Honour."
"Yes, yes, let us go," said Rostov hastily. And lowering his eyes and shrinking, he tried to pass unnoticed between the rows of reproachful, envious eyes that were fixed upon him, and went out of the room. Chapter 18. Going along the corridor, the assistant led Rostov to the officers' wards, consisting of three rooms, the doors of which stood open. There were beds in these rooms, and the sick and wounded officers were lying or sitting on them. Some were walking about the rooms in hospital dressing gowns. The first person Rostov met in the officers' ward was a thin little man with one arm, who was walking about the first room in a nightcap and hospital dressing gown with a pipe between his teeth. Rostov looked at him, trying to remember where he had seen him before.
"See where we met again," said the little man. "Tushin, Tushin, don't you remember, who gave you a lift to Schöngraben? And I've had a bit cut off, you see," he went on with a smile, pointing to the empty sleeve of his dressing gown. "Looking for Vasily Dmitrich Denisov, my neighbour," he added when he heard who Rostov wanted. "Here, here."
And Tushin led him into the next room, from whence came sounds of several laughing voices.
"How can they laugh, or even live at all here?" thought Rostov, still aware of that smell of decomposing flesh that had been so strong in the soldier's ward, and still seeming to see fixed on him those envious looks which had followed him from both sides, and the face of that young soldier with eyes rolled back. Denisov lay asleep on his bed, with his head under the blanket, though it was nearly noon.
"Ah, Rostov! How are you? How are you?"
he called out, still in the same voice as in the regiment, but Rostov noticed sadly that under this habitual ease and animation, some new, sinister, hidden feeling showed itself in the expression of Denisov's face and the intonations of his voice. His wound, though a slight one, had not yet healed even now, 6 weeks after he had been hit. His face had the same swollen pallor as the faces of the other hospital patients, but it was not this that struck Rostov. What struck him was that Denisov did not seem glad to see him, and smiled at him unnaturally. He did not ask about the regiment, nor about the general state of affairs, and when Rostov spoke of these matters, did not listen. Rostov even noticed that Denisov did not like to be reminded of the regiment, or in general of that other free life which was going on outside the hospital. He seemed to try to forget that old life, and was only interested in the affair with the commissariat officers. On Rostov's inquiry as to how the matter stood, he at once produced from under his pillow a paper he had received from the commission, and the rough draft of his answer to it. He became animated when he began reading his paper, and specially drew Rostov's attention to the stinging rejoinders he made to his enemies. His hospital companions, who had gathered round Rostov, a fresh arrival from the world outside, gradually began to disperse as soon as Denisov began reading his answer. Rostov noticed by their faces that all those gentlemen had already heard that story more than once and were tired of it. Only the man in the next bed, a stout Uhlan, continued to sit on his bed, gloomily frowning and smoking a pipe, and little one-armed Tushin still listened, shaking his head disapprovingly. In the middle of the reading, the Uhlan interrupted Denisov.
"But what I say is," he said, turning to Rostov, "it would be best simply to petition the Emperor for pardon. They say great rewards will now be distributed, and surely a pardon would be granted." "Me? Petition the Emperor?" exclaimed Denisov, in a voice to which he tried hard to give the old energy and fire, but which sounded like an expression of irritable impotence. "What for? If I were a wobber, I would ask for mercy, but I'm being court-martialed for bringing wobbers to book. Let them twy me. I'm not afraid of anyone.
I've served the Tsar and my country honourably, and have not stolen. And am I to be degraded? Listen, I'm writing to them straight. This is what I say. If I had wobbed the treasury...
It's certainly well written, said Tushin. But that's not the point, Vasily Dmitrich. And he also turned to Rostov. One has to submit, and Vasily Dmitrich doesn't want to. You know the auditor told you it was a bad business.
Well, let it be bad, said Denisov.
The auditor wrote out a petition for you, continued Tushin, and you ought to sign it and ask this gentleman to take it. No doubt he, indicating Rostov, has connections on the staff. You won't find a better opportunity.
Haven't I said I'm not going to grovel?
Denisov interrupted him and went on reading his paper. Rostov had not the courage to persuade Denisov, though he instinctively felt that the way advised by Tushin and the other officers was the safest, and though he would have been glad to be of service to Denisov. He knew his stubborn will and straightforward, hasty temper. When the reading of Denisov's virulent reply, which took more than an hour, was over, Rostov said nothing, and he spent the rest of the day in a most dejected state of mind, amid Denisov's hospital comrades, who had gathered round him, telling them what he knew and listening to their stories. Denisov was moodily silent all the evening. Late in the evening, when Rostov was about to leave, he asked Denisov whether he had no commission for him.
Yes, wait a bit, said Denisov,
glancing round at the officers, and taking his papers from under his pillow, he went to the window where he had an inkpot and sat down to write.
It seems it's no use knocking one's head against a wall, he said,
coming from the window and giving Rostov a large envelope. In it was the petition to the Emperor drawn up by the auditor, in which Denisov, without alluding to the offences of the commissariat officials, simply asked for pardon.
Hand it in. It seems...
He did not finish, but gave a painfully unnatural smile. Chapter 19 Boris at Tilsit. Having returned to the regiment and told the commander the state of Denisov's affairs, Rostov rode to Tilsit with the letter to the Emperor. On the 13th of June, the French and Russian emperors arrived at Tilsit. Boris Drubetskoy had asked the important personage on whom he was in attendance to include him in the suite appointed for the stay at Tilsit.
"I should like to see the great man," he said, alluding to Napoleon, whom hitherto he, like everyone else, had always called Buonaparte.
"You are speaking of Buonaparte?"
asked the general, smiling.
Boris looked at his general inquiringly, and immediately saw that he was being tested.
"I am speaking, Prince, of the Emperor Napoleon," he replied.
The general patted him on the shoulder with a smile.
"You will go far," he said, and took him to Tilsit with him.
Boris was among the few present at the Niemen on the day the two emperors met. He saw the raft, decorated with monograms, saw Napoleon pass before the French guards on the farther bank of the river, saw the pensive face of the Emperor Alexander as he sat in silence in a tavern on the bank of the Niemen, awaiting Napoleon's arrival. Saw both emperors get into boats, and saw how Napoleon, reaching the raft first, stepped quickly forward to meet Alexander and held out his hand to him, and how they both retired into the pavilion. Since he had begun to move in the highest circles, Boris had made it his habit to watch attentively all that went on around him and to note it down. At the time of the meeting at Tilsit, he asked the names of those who had come with Napoleon and about the uniforms they wore, and listened attentively to words spoken by important personages. At the moment the emperors went into the pavilion, he looked at his watch and did not forget to look at it again when Alexander came out. The interview had lasted an hour and 53 minutes. He noted this down that same evening, among other facts he felt to be of historic importance. As the emperor's suite was a very small one, it was a matter of great importance for a man who valued his success in the service to be at Tilsit on the occasion of this interview between the two emperors, and having succeeded in this, Boris felt that henceforth his position was fully assured. He had not only become known, but people had grown accustomed to him and accepted him. Twice he had executed commissions to the Emperor himself, so that the latter knew his face, and all those at court, far from cold-shouldering him, as at first when they considered him a newcomer, would now have been surprised had he been absent. Boris lodged with another adjutant, the Polish Count Zieliński. Zieliński, a Pole brought up in Paris, was rich and passionately fond of the French, and almost every day of the stay at Tilsit, French officers of the Guard and from French headquarters were dining and lunching with him and Boris. On the evening of the 24th of June, Count Zieliński arranged a supper for his French friends. The guest of honour was an aide-de-camp of Napoleon's. There were also several French officers of the Guard, and a page of Napoleon's, a young lad of an old aristocratic French family. That same day, Rostov, profiting by the darkness to avoid being recognised in civilian dress, came to Tilsit and went to the lodging occupied by Boris and Zieliński. Rostov, in common with the whole army from which he came, was far from having experienced the change of feeling toward Napoleon and the French, who, from being foes, had suddenly become friends, that had taken place at headquarters and in Boris. In the army, Bonaparte and the French were still regarded with mingled feelings of anger, contempt, and fear. Only recently, talking with one of Platov's Cossack officers, Rostov had argued that if Napoleon were taken prisoner, he would be treated not as a sovereign, but as a criminal. Quite lately, happening to meet a wounded French colonel on the road, Rostov had maintained with heat that peace was impossible between a legitimate sovereign and the criminal Bonaparte. Rostov was therefore unpleasantly struck by the presence of French officers in Boris's lodging, dressed in uniforms he had been accustomed to see from quite a different point of view from the outposts of the flank. As soon as he noticed a French officer who thrust his head out of the door, that warlike feeling of hostility which he always experienced at the sight of the enemy suddenly seized him. He stopped at the threshold and asked in Russian whether Drubetskoy lived there. Boris, hearing a strange voice in the anteroom, came out to meet him. An expression of annoyance showed itself for a moment on his face on first recognizing Rostov. "Ah, it's you. Very glad to see you," he said, however, coming toward him with a smile. But Rostov had noticed his first impulse. "I've come at a bad time, I think. I should not have come, but I have business," he said coldly. "No, I only wonder how you managed to get away from your regiment." "Dans un moment, je suis à vous," he said, answering someone who called him. "I see I'm intruding," Rostov repeated. The look of annoyance had already disappeared from Boris's face. Having evidently reflected and decided how to act, he very quietly took both Rostov's hands and led him into the next room. His eyes, looking serenely and steadily at Rostov, seemed to be veiled by something, as if screened by blue spectacles of conventionality. So it seemed to Rostov. "Oh, come now, as if you could come at a wrong time," said Boris, and he led him into the room where the supper table was laid and introduced him to his guests, explaining that he was not a civilian, but an hussar officer and an old friend of his. "Count Zieliński, le comte N.N., le capitaine S.S.," said he, naming his guests. Rostov looked frowningly at the Frenchman, bowed reluctantly, and remained silent. Zieliński evidently did not receive this new Russian person very willingly into his circle, and did not speak to Rostov. Boris did not appear to notice the constraint the newcomer produced, and with the same pleasant composure and the same veiled look in his eyes with which he had met Rostov, tried to enliven the conversation. One of the Frenchmen, with the polite characteristic of his countrymen, addressed the obstinately taciturn Rostov, saying that the latter had probably come to Tilsit to see the Emperor. "No, I came on business," replied Rostov briefly. Rostov had been out of humour from the moment he noticed the look of dissatisfaction on Boris's face, and as always happens to those in a bad humour, it seemed to him that everyone regarded him with aversion and that he was in everybody's way. He really was in their way, for he alone took no part in the conversation, which again became general. The looks the visitors cast on him seemed to say, "And what is he sitting here for?" He rose and went up to Boris.
"Anyhow, I'm in your way," he said in a low tone. "Come and talk over my business, and I'll go away."
"Oh, no, not at all," said Boris. "But if you are tired, come and lie down in my room and have a rest."
"Yes, really."
They went into the little room where Boris slept. Rostov, without sitting down, began at once, irritably, as if Boris were to blame in some way, telling him about Denisov's affair, asking him whether, through his general, he could and would intercede with the Emperor on Denisov's behalf and get Denisov's petition handed in. When he and Boris were alone, Rostov felt for the first time that he could not look Boris in the face without a sense of awkwardness. Boris, with one leg crossed over the other and stroking his left hand with the slender fingers of his right, listened to Rostov as a general listens to the report of a subordinate, now looking aside and now gazing straight into Rostov's eyes with the same veiled look. Each time this happened, Rostov felt uncomfortable and cast down his eyes.
"I have heard of such cases, and know that His Majesty is very severe in such affairs. I think it would be best not to bring it before the Emperor, but to apply to the commander of the corps. But in general, I think..."
"So you don't want to do anything? Well, then say so!"
Rostov almost shouted, not looking Boris in the face. Boris smiled.
"On the contrary, I will do what I can. Only I thought..."
At that moment, Zhilinsky's voice was heard calling Boris.
"Well then, go, go, go,"
said Rostov, and refusing supper and remaining alone in the little room, he walked up and down for a long time, hearing the light-hearted French conversation from the next room. Chapter 20. Nikolai tries to present Denisov's petition. Rostov had come to Tilsit the day least suitable for a petition on Denisov's behalf. He could not himself go to the general in attendance, as he was in mufti, and had come to Tilsit without permission to do so. And Boris, even had he wished to, could not have done so on the following day. On that day, June the 27th, the preliminaries of peace were signed. The emperors exchanged decorations. Alexander received the cross of the Legion of Honour, and Napoleon the Order of St. Andrew of the First Degree, and a dinner had been arranged for the evening, given by a battalion of the French Guards to the Preobrazhensk Battalion. The emperors were to be present at that banquet. Rostov felt so ill at ease and uncomfortable with Boris that when the latter looked in after supper, he pretended to be asleep, and early next morning went away avoiding Boris. In his civilian clothes and a round hat, he wandered about the town, staring at the French and their uniforms, and at the streets and houses where the Russian and French emperors were staying. In a square he saw tables being set up and preparations made for the dinner. He saw the Russian and French colours draped from side to side of the streets, with huge monograms A and N. In the windows of the houses also flags and bunting were displayed. "Boris doesn't want to help me, and I don't want to ask him. That's settled," thought Nikolai. "All is over between us, but I won't leave here without having done all I can for Denisov, and certainly not without getting his letter to the Emperor." "The Emperor? He is here," thought Rostov, who had unconsciously returned to the house where Alexander lodged. Saddled horses were standing before the house, and the suite were assembling, evidently preparing for the Emperor to come out. "I may see him at any moment," thought Rostov. "If only I were to hand the letter direct to him and tell him all, could they really arrest me for my civilian clothes? Surely not. He would understand on whose side justice lies. He understands everything, knows everything. Who can be more just, more magnanimous than he? And even if they did arrest me for being here, what would it matter?" thought he, looking at an officer who was entering the house the Emperor occupied. "After all, people do go in. It's all nonsense. I'll go in and hand the letter to the Emperor myself. So much the worse for Drubetskoy, who drives me to it." And suddenly, with a determination he himself did not expect, Rostov felt for the letter in his pocket and went straight to the house.
No, I won't miss my opportunity now as I did after Austerlitz, he thought, expecting every moment to meet the monarch, and conscious of the blood that rushed to his heart at the thought. I will fall at his feet and beseech him. He will lift me up, will listen, and will even thank me. I am happy when I can do good, but to remedy injustice is the greatest happiness, Rostov fancied the sovereign saying. And passing people who looked after him with curiosity, he entered the porch of the emperor's house. A broad staircase led straight up from the entry, and to the right he saw a closed door. Below, under the staircase, was a door leading to the lower floor.
"Whom do you want?" someone inquired.
"To hand in a letter, a petition to His Majesty," said Nikolai with a tremor in his voice.
"A petition? This way, to the officer on duty."
He was shown the door leading downstairs.
"Only it won't be accepted."
On hearing this indifferent voice, Rostov grew frightened at what he was doing. The thought of meeting the emperor at any moment was so fascinating and consequently so alarming that he was ready to run away, but the official who had questioned him opened the door and Rostov entered. A short, stout man of about 30, in white breeches and high boots and a batiste shirt that he had evidently only just put on, was standing in that room, and his valet was buttoning onto the back of his breeches a new pair of handsome, silk-embroidered braces that for some reason attracted Rostov's attention. This man was speaking to someone in the adjoining room.
"A good figure, and in her first bloom," he was saying, but on seeing Rostov he stopped short and frowned.
"What is it? A petition?"
"What is it?"
asked the person in the other room.
"Another petitioner,"
answered the man with the braces.
"Tell him to come later. He'll be coming out directly. We must go."
"Later, later. Tomorrow. It's too late."
Rostov turned and was about to go, but the man in the braces stopped him.
"Whom have you come from? Who are you?"
"I come from Major Denisov," answered Rostov.
"Are you an officer?"
"Lieutenant Count Rostov."
"What audacity! Hand it in through your commander, and go along with you. Go!"
And he continued to put on the uniform the valet handed him. Rostov went back into the hall and noticed that in the porch there were many officers and generals in full parade uniform whom he had to pass. Cursing his temerity, his heart sinking at the thought of finding himself at any moment face to face with the emperor and being put to shame and arrested in his presence, fully alive now to the impropriety of his conduct and repenting of it, Rostov, with downcast eyes, was making his way out of the house through the brilliant suite when a familiar voice called him, and a hand detained him.
"What are you doing here, sir, in civilian dress?"
asked a deep voice. It was a cavalry general who had obtained the emperor's special favour during this campaign, and who had formerly commanded the division in which Rostov was serving. Rostov, in dismay, began justifying himself, but seeing the kindly, jocular face of the general, he took him aside, and in an excited voice told him the whole affair, asking him to intercede for Denisov, whom the general knew. Having heard Rostov to the end, the general shook his head gravely.
"I'm sorry, sorry for that fine fellow. Give me the letter."
Hardly had Rostov handed him the letter and finished explaining Denisov's case, when hasty steps and the jingling of spurs were heard on the stairs, and the general, leaving him, went to the porch. The gentlemen of the emperor's suite ran down the stairs and went to their horses. Hayne, the same groom who had been at Austerlitz, led up the emperor's horse, and the faint creak of a footstep Rostov knew at once was heard on the stairs. Forgetting the danger of being recognized, Rostov went close to the porch, together with some inquisitive civilians, and again, after 2 years, saw those features he adored. That same face, and same look and step, and the same union of majesty and mildness. And the feeling of enthusiasm and love for his sovereign rose again in Rostov's soul with all its old force. In the uniform of the Preobrazhensk regiment, white chamois leather breeches and high boots, and wearing a star Rostov did not know, it was that of the Légion d'honneur, The monarch came out into the porch, putting on his gloves and carrying his hat under his arm. He stopped and looked about him, brightening everything around by his glance. He spoke a few words to some of the generals, and recognizing the former commander of Rostov's division, smiled and beckoned to him. All the suite drew back, and Rostov saw the general talking for some time to the emperor. The emperor said a few words to him and took a step toward his horse. Again the crowd of members of the suite and street-gazers, among whom was Rostov, moved nearer to the emperor. Stopping beside his horse, with his hand on the saddle, the emperor turned to the cavalry general and said in a loud voice, evidently wishing to be heard by all, "I cannot do it, general. I cannot, because the law is stronger than I." And he raised his foot to the stirrup. The general bowed his head respectfully, and the monarch mounted and rode down the street at a gallop. Beside himself with enthusiasm, Rostov ran after him with the crowd. Chapter 21. Napoleon and Alexander as Allies. The emperor rode to the square, where, facing one another, a battalion of the Preobrazhensk regiment stood on the right and a battalion of the French guards in their bearskin caps on the left. As the Tsar rode up to one flank of the battalions, which presented arms, another group of horsemen galloped up to the opposite flank, and at the head of them Rostov recognized Napoleon. It could be no one else. He came at a gallop, wearing a small hat, a blue uniform opened over a white vest, and the St. Andrew ribbon over his shoulder. He was riding a very fine thoroughbred grey Arab horse with a crimson gold-embroidered saddle-cloth. On approaching Alexander, he raised his hat, and as he did so, Rostov, with his cavalryman's eye, could not help noticing that Napoleon did not sit well or firmly in the saddle. The battalions shouted, "Hurrah! And vive l'Empereur!" Napoleon said something to Alexander, and both emperors dismounted and took each other's hands. Napoleon's face wore an unpleasant and artificial smile. Alexander was saying something affable to him. In spite of the trampling of the French gendarmes' horses, which were pushing back the crowd, Rostov kept his eyes on every movement of Alexander and Bonaparte. It struck him as a surprise that Alexander treated Bonaparte as an equal, and that the latter was quite at ease with the Tsar, as if such relations with an emperor were an everyday matter to him. Alexander and Napoleon, with the long train of their suites, approached the right flank of the Preobrazhensk battalion and came straight up to the crowd standing there. The crowd unexpectedly found itself so close to the emperor's that Rostov, standing in the front row, was afraid he might be recognized.
"Sire, I ask your permission to present the Légion d'honneur to the bravest of your soldiers," said a sharp, precise voice, articulating every letter. This was said by the undersized Napoleon, looking up straight into Alexander's eyes. Alexander listened attentively to what was said to him, and bending his head, smiled pleasantly. "To him who has borne himself most bravely in this last war," added Napoleon, accentuating each syllable, as with a composure and assurance exasperating to Rostov, he ran his eyes over the Russian ranks drawn up before him, who all presented arms with their eyes fixed on their emperor.
"Will your Majesty allow me to consult the colonel?" said Alexander, and took a few hasty steps toward Prince Kozlovsky, the commander of the battalion. Bonaparte, meanwhile, began taking the glove off his small white hand, tore it in doing so, and threw it away. An aide-de-camp behind him rushed forward and picked it up.
"To whom shall it be given?" the Emperor Alexander asked Kozlovsky in Russian in a low voice.
"To whomever your Majesty commands."
The Emperor knit his brows with dissatisfaction and, glancing back, remarked,
"But we must give him an answer."
Kozlovsky scanned the ranks resolutely and included Rostov in his scrutiny.
"Can it be me?" thought Rostov.
"Lazarev!"
the colonel called with a frown. And Lazarev, the first soldier in the rank, stepped briskly forward.
"Where are you off to? Stop here!"
voices whispered to Lazarev, who did not know where to go. Lazarev stopped, casting a sidelong look at his colonel in alarm. His face twitched, as often happens to soldiers called before the ranks. Napoleon slightly turned his head and put his plump little hand out behind him as if to take something. The members of his suite, guessing at once what he wanted, moved about and whispered as they passed something from one to another, and a page, the same one Rostov had seen the previous evening at Boris's, ran forward, and bowing respectfully over the outstretched hand and not keeping it waiting a moment, laid in it an order on a red ribbon. Napoleon, without looking, pressed two fingers together and the badge was between them. Then he approached Lazarev, who rolled his eyes and persistently gazed at his own monarch, looked round at the Emperor Alexander to imply that what he was now doing was done for the sake of his ally, and the small white hand holding the order touched one of Lazarev's buttons. It was as if Napoleon knew that it was only necessary for his hand to deign to touch that soldier's breast for the soldier to be for ever happy, rewarded, and distinguished from everyone else in the world. Napoleon merely laid the cross on Lazarev's breast and, dropping his hand, turned toward Alexander as though sure that the cross would adhere there. And it really did. Officious hands, Russian and French, immediately seized the cross and fastened it to the uniform. Lazarev glanced morosely at the little man with white hands who was doing something to him, and still standing motionless, presenting arms, looked again straight into Alexander's eyes, as if asking whether he should stand there or go away or do something else. But receiving no orders, he remained for some time in that rigid position. The emperors remounted and rode away. The Preobrazhensk battalion, breaking rank, mingled with the French guards and sat down at the tables prepared for them. Lazarev sat in the place of honour. Russian and French officers embraced him, congratulated him, and pressed his hands. Crowds of officers and civilians drew near merely to see him. A rumble of Russian and French voices and laughter filled the air around the tables in the square. Two officers with flushed faces, looking cheerful and happy, passed by Rostov. "What do you think of the treat? All on silver plate," one of them was saying. "Have you seen Lazarev?" "I have. Tomorrow, I hear, the Preobrazhenskys will give them a dinner." "Yes, but what luck for Lazarev. 1,200 francs pension for life." "Here's a cap, lads," shouted a Preobrazhensk soldier, donning a shaggy French cap. "It's a fine thing, first rate."
"Have you heard the password?" asked one guards officer of another. "The day before yesterday, it was Napoleon, France, bravoure. Yesterday, Alexandre, Russie, grandeur. One day our emperor gives it, and next day Napoleon. Tomorrow our emperor will send a St. George's cross to the bravest of the French guards. It has to be done. He must respond in kind."
Boris, too, with his friend Zhilinsky, came to see the Preobrazhensk banquet. On his way back, he noticed Rostov standing by the corner of a house.
"Rostov, how do you do? We missed one another," he said, and could not refrain from asking what was the matter. So strangely dismal and troubled was Rostov's face.
"Nothing, nothing," replied Rostov.
"You'll call round?"
"Yes, I will."
Rostov stood at that corner for a long time, watching the feast from a distance. In his mind, a painful process was going on which he could not bring to a conclusion. Terrible doubts rose in his soul. Now he remembered Denisov with his changed expression, his submission, and the whole hospital with arms and legs torn off and its dirt and disease. So vividly did he recall that hospital stench of dead flesh that he looked round to see where the smell came from. Next he thought of that self-satisfied Bonaparte, with his small white hand, who was now an emperor, liked and respected by Alexander. Then why those severed arms and legs and those dead men? Then again he thought of Lazarev rewarded and Denisov punished and unpardoned. He caught himself harbouring such strange thoughts that he was frightened. The smell of the food the Preobrazhenskys were eating and a sense of hunger recalled him from these reflections. He had to get something to eat before going away. He went to a hotel he had noticed that morning. There he found so many people, among them officers who, like himself, had come in civilian clothes, that he had difficulty in getting a dinner. Two officers of his own division joined him. The conversation naturally turned on the peace. The officers, his comrades, like most of the army, were dissatisfied with the peace concluded after the Battle of Friedland. They said that had we held out a little longer, Napoleon would have been done for, as his troops had neither provisions nor ammunition. Nikolai ate and drank, chiefly the latter, in silence. He finished a couple of bottles of wine by himself. The process in his mind went on tormenting him without reaching a conclusion. He feared to give way to his thoughts, yet could not get rid of them. Suddenly, on one of the officers saying that it was humiliating to look at the French, Rostov began shouting with uncalled-for wrath, and therefore much to the surprise of the officers. "How can you judge what's best?" he cried, the blood suddenly rushing to his face. "How can you judge the Emperor's actions? What right have we to argue? We cannot comprehend either the Emperor's aims or his actions."
"But I never said a word about the Emperor," said the officer, justifying himself, and unable to understand Rostov's outburst, except on the supposition that he was drunk. But Rostov did not listen to him.
"We are not diplomatic officials. We are soldiers and nothing more," he went on. "If we are ordered to die, we must die. If we're punished, it means that we've deserved it. It's not for us to judge. If the Emperor pleases to recognize Bonaparte as Emperor and to conclude an alliance with him, it means that that is the right thing to do. If once we begin judging and arguing about everything, nothing sacred will be left. That way we shall be saying there is no God, nothing!"
shouted Nikolai, banging the table, very little to the point as it seemed to his listeners, but quite relevantly to the course of his own thoughts.
"Our business is to do our duty, to fight and not to think, that's all," said he.
"And to drink," said one of the officers, not wishing to quarrel.
"Yes, and to drink," assented Nikolai. "Hello there! Another bottle!" he shouted.
Book 6, 1808 to 1810. Chapter 1, Prince Andrei's Occupations at Boguchárovo. In 1808, the Emperor Alexander went to Erfurt for a fresh interview with the Emperor Napoleon, and in the upper circles of Petersburg there was much talk of the grandeur of this important meeting. In 1809, the intimacy between the world's two arbiters, as Napoleon and Alexander were called, was such that when Napoleon declared war on Austria, a Russian corps crossed the frontier to cooperate with our old enemy, Bonaparte, against our old ally, the Emperor of Austria. And in court circles, the possibility of marriage between Napoleon and one of Alexander's sisters was spoken of. But besides considerations of foreign policy, the attention of Russian society was at that time keenly directed on the internal changes that were being undertaken in all the departments of government. Life, meanwhile, real life, with its essential interests of health and sickness, toil and rest, and its intellectual interests in thought, science, poetry, music, love, friendship, hatred, and passions, went on as usual, independently of and apart from political friendship or enmity with Napoleon Bonaparte and from all the schemes of reconstruction. Prince Andrei had spent 2 years continuously in the country. All the plans Pierre had attempted on his estates, and constantly changing from one thing to another had never accomplished, were carried out by Prince Andrei without display and without perceptible difficulty. He had in the highest degree a practical tenacity which Pierre lacked, and without fuss or strain on his part, this set things going. On one of his estates, the 300 serfs were liberated and became free agricultural labourers, this being one of the first examples of the kind in Russia. On other estates, the serfs' compulsory labour was commuted for a quit rent. A trained midwife was engaged for Boguchárovo at his expense, and a priest was paid to teach reading and writing to the children of the peasants and household serfs. Prince Andrei spent half his time at Bald Hills with his father and his son, who was still in the care of nurses. The other half he spent in Bogucharova Cloister, as his father called Prince Andrei's estate. Despite the indifference to the affairs of the world he had expressed to Pierre, he diligently followed all that went on, received many books, and to his surprise noticed that when he or his father had visitors from Petersburg, the very vortex of life, these people lagged behind himself, who never left the country, in knowledge of what was happening in home and foreign affairs. Besides being occupied with his estates and reading a great variety of books, Prince Andrei was at this time busy with a critical survey of our last two unfortunate campaigns, and with drawing up a proposal for a reform of the army rules and regulations. In the spring of 1809, he went to visit the Ryazan estates, which had been inherited by his son, whose guardian he was. Warmed by the spring sunshine, he sat in the calèche looking at the new grass, the first leaves on the birches, and the first puffs of white spring clouds floating across the clear blue sky. He was not thinking of anything, but looked absent-mindedly and cheerfully from side to side. They crossed the ferry where he had talked with Pierre the year before. They went through the muddy village, past threshing floors and green fields of winter rye, downhill where snow still lodged near the bridge, uphill where the clay had been liquefied by the rain, past strips of stubble land and bushes touched with green here and there, and into a birch forest growing on both sides of the road. In the forest it was almost hot. No wind could be felt. The birches with their sticky green leaves were motionless, and lilac-coloured flowers and the first blades of green grass were pushing up and lifting last year's leaves. The coarse, evergreen colour of the small fir trees scattered here and there among the birches was an unpleasant reminder of winter. On entering the forest, the horses began to snort and sweated visibly. Piotr, the footman, made some remark to the coachman. The latter assented, but apparently the coachman's sympathy was not enough for Piotr, and he turned on the box toward his master.
"How pleasant it is, Your Excellency," he said with a respectful smile.
"What?"
"It's pleasant, Your Excellency."
What is he talking about? Thought Prince Andrei. Oh, the spring, I suppose, he thought as he turned around. Yes, really, everything is green already. How early. The birches and cherry and alders, too, are coming out. But the oaks show no sign yet. Ah, here is one oak. At the edge of the road stood an oak, probably 10 times the age of the birches that formed the forest. It was 10 times as thick and twice as tall as they. It was an enormous tree, its girth twice as great as a man could embrace, and evidently long ago some of its branches had been broken off and its bark scarred. With its huge, ungainly limbs, sprawling unsymmetrically, and its gnarled hands and fingers, it stood an aged, stern and scornful monster among the smiling birch trees. Only the dead-looking evergreen firs dotted about in the forest, and this oak, refused to yield to the charm of spring, or notice either the spring or the sunshine. "Spring, love, happiness," this oak seemed to say. "Are you not weary of that stupid, meaningless, constantly repeated fraud? Always the same and always a fraud. There is no spring, no sun, no happiness. Look at those cramped, dead firs, ever the same, and at me too, sticking out my broken and barked fingers just where they have grown, whether from my back or my sides. As they have grown, so I stand, and I do not believe in your hopes and your lies." As he passed through the forest, Prince Andrei turned several times to look at that oak, as if expecting something from it. Under the oak, too, were flowers and grass, but it stood among them scowling, rigid, misshapen, and grim as ever. "Yes, the oak is right, 1,000 times right," thought Prince Andrei. "Let others, the young, yield afresh to that fraud, but we know life. Our life is finished." A whole sequence of new thoughts, hopeless but mournfully pleasant, rose in his soul in connection with that tree. During this journey he, as it were, considered his life afresh and arrived at his old conclusion, restful in its hopelessness, that it was not for him to begin anything anew, but that he must live out his life, content to do no harm, and not disturbing himself or desiring anything. Chapter 2. Prince Andrei's visit to the Rostovs at Otradnoye. Prince Andrei had to see the marshal of the nobility for the district, in connection with the affairs of the Ryazan estate of which he was trustee. This marshal was Count Ilya Rostov, and in the middle of May Prince Andrei went to visit him. It was now hot spring weather. The whole forest was already clothed in green. It was dusty and so hot that on passing near water one longed to bathe. Prince Andrei, depressed and preoccupied with the business about which he had to speak to the marshal, was driving up the avenue in the grounds of the Rostovs' house at Otradnoye. He heard merry girlish cries from behind some trees on the right and saw a group of girls running to cross the path of his calèche. Ahead of the rest and nearer to him ran a dark-haired, remarkably slim, pretty girl in a yellow chintz dress with a white handkerchief on her head, from under which loose locks of hair escaped. The girl was shouting something, but, seeing that he was a stranger, ran back laughing without looking at him. Suddenly, he did not know why, he felt a pang. The day was so beautiful, the sun so bright, everything around so gay, but that slim, pretty girl did not know or wish to know of his existence, and was contented and cheerful in her own separate, probably foolish, but bright and happy life. What is she so glad about? What is she thinking of? Not of the military regulations, or of the arrangements of the Ryazan serfs' quitrent. Of what is she thinking? Why is she so happy? Prince Andrei asked himself with instinctive curiosity. In 1809, Count Ilya Rostov was living at Otradnoye just as he had done in former years, that is, entertaining almost the whole province with hunts, theatricals, dinners, and music. He was glad to see Prince Andrei, as he was to see any new visitor, and insisted on his staying the night. During the dull day, in the course of which he was entertained by his elderly hosts and by the more important of the visitors, the old count's house was crowded on account of an approaching name day, Prince Andrei repeatedly glanced at Natasha, gay and laughing among the younger members of the company, and asked himself each time, "What is she thinking about? Why is she so glad?" That night, alone in new surroundings, he was long unable to sleep. He read a while and then put out his candle, but relit it. It was hot in the room, the inside shutters of which were closed. He was cross with the stupid old man, as he called Rostov, who had made him stay by assuring him that some necessary documents had not yet arrived from town, and he was vexed with himself for having stayed. He got up and went to the window to open it. As soon as he opened the shutters, the moonlight, as if it had long been watching for this, burst into the room. He opened the casement. The night was fresh, bright, and very still. Just before the window was a row of pollard trees, looking black on one side and with a silvery light on the other. Beneath the trees grew some kind of lush, wet, bushy vegetation, with silver-lit leaves and stems here and there. Farther back, beyond the dark trees, a roof glittered with dew. To the right was a leafy tree with brilliantly white trunk and branches, and above it shone the moon, nearly at its full, in a pale, almost starless spring sky. Prince Andrei leaned his elbows on the window ledge, and his eyes rested on that sky. His room was on the first floor. Those in the rooms above were also awake. He heard female voices overhead.
"Just once more," said a girlish voice above him, which Prince Andrei recognized at once.
"But when are you coming to bed?" replied another voice. "I won't, I can't sleep. What's the use?
Come now, for the last time." The two girlish voices sang a musical passage, the end of some song.
"Oh, how lovely! Now go to sleep, and there's an end of it." "You go to sleep, but I can't," said the first voice, coming nearer to the window.
She was evidently leaning right out, for the rustle of her dress and even her breathing could be heard. Everything was stone.